Welcome to Coaching the Doctor. Thanks to Gildacare, support coordinators, where it takes a village.
Welcome to another Best Bits episode of Coach and the Doctor. Trigger warning, this contains content about suicide. In the next 30 minutes or so, we will be talking, amongst many things, depression and anxiety and the way to manage them and, in fact, at times, thrive. Graham Cowan is an author, speaker and board director at Are You OK? In the early 2000s, Graham went through a period of depression and four suicide attempts and was part of the team that started Are You OK? Ashley Morton joins us with our travel segment, but first up after the break, Joe Williams makes an appearance. He's a suicide prevention and well-being educator and a former NRL star and boxing world champion. That's next here on Coach and the Doctor Best Bits. Thanks to J-Man Active. If the body is active, the mind will follow.
Are you or someone you know in need of a compassionate support coordinator? Gildacare is your team of trusted, caring and professional support coordinators. We'll make the NDIS process easy for you and your loved ones to navigate. We'll coordinate all your care and support, specialist support and, if required, psychosocial recovery coaching. GILDA, Gildacare Support Coordination. We make the NDIS process stress-free. Visit us at gildacare.com.au.
J-Man inspires and supports NDIS participants to live their best lives and promotes experiences for people with a disability. The NDIS can be confusing, so if you're thinking about applying for funding or not sure how your plan actually works, J-Man can help and guide you through every step of the process at no cost to you. jman.com.au. That's jaeman.com.au. Now is the time to get the most out of your NDIS. Call us for a free consultation. 1-800-JMAN.
When your message is timely, trustworthy and delivered in a positive environment, it's powerful. That's why sponsors of 89.9 The Light see great results. Visit thelight.com.au.
You're listening to Coach and the Doctor, thanks to Gildacare Support Coordinators, where it takes a village. Doctor, welcome along, Doctor.
Thank you, Coach. Doctor. Great to be here.
And Coach, not a real coach. Now, with us is a man, well, let me just read some of his bio. His name is Joe Williams. He's a suicide prevention and well-being educator. Joe is a proud Wiradjuri Wagaloo, a First Nations Australian man, born in Cowra, raised in Wagga, New South Wales, Australia, and a former NRL player. Joe, there's a few things there that you and I have in common, but first of all, I want to talk rugby league.
Well, can I ask the first question? Yeah, because I don't really want to talk about the NRL. I'm going to say, Joe, who do you follow in the AFL, more importantly?
Oh, gee.
I follow the Swans. If I'm honest, I believe it's a better game.
Thank you. That's all I need to hear right now.
I think it's a game, and me being a Wiradjuri Wagaloo man, First Nation man, it's a game that was derived from one of our games. When we talk about mongrel, the game of what Australian rules is now is one of our original games. So I believe it's a game built for our people. You know, if I'm honest, my oldest boy plays AFL, doesn't play league.
I think that's great. So we don't have to talk about the NRL or the state of origin. So let's just talk about the pure game.
Having said that, Joe, what sort of memories do you have playing rugby league in the NRL? There you go, Doctor. I've asked that question because we've got to get that out of the way. Well, look at some of the teams, the South Sydney, Penrith, and the Bulldogs as well. And then you ended up being a boxer. We'll get onto that in a minute.
You know, like I was a kid. I was just a kid like any kids that we know that grew up with dreams in his eyes to be a rugby league player. My dad played in the Winfield Cup. The Winfield Cup was the New South Wales rugby league before you know, the Queensland national influence, yeah, and the New Zealand influence, and then making it a national game.
I do want to ask some questions pertinent to what we're talking about here,
yeah,
and Joe's life post-rugby league and boxing. And kind of just want to talk to you about your bipolar disorder. When was that first diagnosed?
Back in 2010.
So pretty much up until then. So how old were you there?
What are we, 12 years ago?
Okay, so you're an adult is what I'm saying.
Yeah, I was an adult. Yeah. So
it was post-NRL, post-boxing?
Post-rugby league career. It was during my boxing career. It was actually on the back of a marriage breakdown. One of the things that come out of that, I guess the wash up out of that marriage breakdown is that my ex-wife said, Joe, I think you've got bipolar. I just thought it was, you know, like, not many marriages end amicably, right? Yeah. So I just thought it was
because I thought it was a pot shot.
Because and the times and the understandings or the lack of understanding around what it was, and then when I was diagnosed and I started to look more into it and understand more about bipolar disorder, and I'm like, I was asked the question, what was it like when you were diagnosed with bipolar disorder? I was like, well, it made sense because of the erraticness of my life, some of the behaviours that I was showing around different things. So it made sense.
Was it a relief in some respects?
The time frame of it, right? I still thought something was wrong with me, okay? Because of the, you know, if we think there's stigma about mental illness now, think about what it was like in 2010. Only in the clinic's chair was it spoken about. It made sense to me. It was a relief. It was like, wow, actually, I know what it's like. I know what this is now. I guess the journey of it being medicated and I would say wrongly medicated and then over medicated and under medicated, and the journey of finding what works. I was actually based in the US doing a lot of work in the US and out here, sort of month on month off sort of thing. And I saw a psych in the US, and then I was put on a mood stabilizer, and I was like, wow, this is what it's like to be like level, like. But then the journey of that, and I haven't told this story often, I went to a funeral and I couldn't cry. I was upset, but the tears just wouldn't come out, and I couldn't understand what was going on with that. And I said to myself, and I'm someone who's a very self-aware person, particularly when I got sober and clean from alcohol and drugs. You know when you're up and you know when you're down, right? It's about finding out when you're up and when you're down, or why you're up and why you're down, right? So I said to myself, I've just lost someone extremely close to me in my life and my family, and I can't even grieve. I can't cry. And obviously, I think that was because of the mood stabilizer that was stopping me from going so low or stopping me from going so high. And then that's when I actually said to my partner, I said, because I finished the medication that I was on, and I'd actually spoke to another doctor about getting on some new stuff, but he said, I want to take you onto another medication, but we need to take you off the one that you're on now, right? So we need to titrate you down. And then when I got completely down, I said, I want to stay off it. And I made a promise to my partner. I said, if I get too down and my behaviors are beyond my control, as far as my erraticness, my highs and my lows, if my behaviours are beyond my control, because as we know with people with bipolar disorder, we don't know that we're impacting other people until we're deep in it. I said, I need you to make a promise to me, and if I need to go back to the clinic, I need to go back to the clinic. If I need to go back to the hospital, I need to go back to the hospital. I'm going to promise you I'll trust you, but I need you to promise me that you'll call me out on these behaviours. And that was close to 7 years ago now, and I haven't been medicated since.
So you're not on any medication for...
Not a bit, no. No medication at all. Again, someone who's super, super duper self-aware. So I still have the highs and the lows, without doubt. I still have those. It's just that I have different cultural practices now for me that keep me leveled, especially when I'm high. And a life as an ex-athlete, a commitment to more exercise when I'm low.
So can you describe some of those moments out of...
Which one? Which one's the highs or the lows?
Yeah, well, both, either, whatever. Can you remember some of those moments that have stuck out in your mind as somewhere you don't want to go again?
Well, this is the thing, right, is that those highs and lows still happen. It's not as if I stopped taking medication and my bipolar went away. I've still very much got the behaviours of bipolar disorder. I just know how to manage it better now.
Right.
And I've got the people around me to call me out on the behaviours when I'm high.
So if somebody does call you out on it, what's typically your reaction to that? Is your automatic reaction to go, I'm fine, or do you sit back and go, okay, I need to kind of analyse the last week, the last 2 weeks, last month?
It's always our first response, isn't it? It's always like, I'm all right, I know what I'm doing, leave me alone. That's a lot of people's first response. The
Absolutely.
Initial thought process that goes in their mind, right? For me, it's more like a... It's, particularly when I'm manic, I'm a spender. I went to the shop this morning, actually. I went to the shop, and you don't realise until you've done it. I went to the shop this morning, and I only went there for a loaf of bread. But I got a loaf of bread, and I got some crumpets, and I got some cereal, and then I got out of the shop, and I went, I haven't got some butter, so I went around the servo to get some butter. Like, my mind just goes a million miles an hour, and then I get out of it, and I go, I didn't need this stuff. Here's an example of mania. I come home from a trip from the US, right, doing some work in the US, and I was paid quite a substantial lump sum of money. I spent 15K a week.
On
clothes. I bought like six suits. Like, there's only one of me.
Like, you like suits, one. Obviously.
I can only wear one. Like, and it was just stuff I just went, I don't need any of this stuff. What am I doing? The other side of the scale is that when I'm super duper low, I'm a terrible person to be around. I don't want to get out of bed. I'm snappy, and that's not a good job for someone who's should be out in the world trying to motivate and potentially help people. You know, so it's about the management. Like, if I eat rubbish and don't exercise continuously for a month, there's every chance I'll slip down a hole of depression.
When you are in those moments, so you've bought the six suits. And you go, Joe, you're a dickhead. Why did you buy six suits? Do you beat yourself up on that, or do you just go, okay, I realise what I've done. I need to fix that and just move forward? And then the other part of the question is, when you're low and you're in bed, not wanting to get up, how do you get yourself up?
I've got to convince the boss first. I've got to tell her that I just spent 10 grand on suits, which never goes down well.
No.
But it's like I come home from the shop this morning, you know, and the same sort of thing. And it's those moments of, as soon as you know that you're up, that's when you can start to pull yourself down or do the behaviours that you need to do to pull yourself back down, like your meditations and stuff like that, right?
Right.
So what I do is I do my best to let it go. I do my best to accept it. I'm also a believer, right, of that for us culturally, we believe that everything happens the way it's supposed to happen on the day that it's supposed to happen at exactly the time it's supposed to happen, right? So if I go out and buy 10 suits, for 100,000 years, every day was leading to me buying those 10 suits. What I do next is most important, right? So I can't control what I'd done, or I can't change what I'd done because I was always going to do it. Forever.
You're predestined to do it.
Yeah, I believe that I was predestined to do certain things, right? It's a tough pill to swallow at times. So for me, acceptance has been my biggest thing. And again, going back to the moments of the initial times of bipolar disorder and when going through my biggest moments of recovery and discovery is that acceptance has been the biggest thing. I may have these behaviours for the absolute rest of my life. I've got to accept that they may be there forever because a lot of people get in trouble when they go, oh, shit, I didn't think that I'd get to this point again. I hear it all the time. I've beaten depression. I've beaten my anxiety. And then I'm cradling that person a month later because they're back down to exactly where they were. For me, it's about management of different things, different behaviours in how I respond to things, the different physical behaviours on reaction of my first response in my brain.
Joe, you mentioned to Amy earlier, our producer, that you have a talent, so we've got to be very careful what we say around you, even if we turn the microphones off. Can you let us know what that is?
It's funny, you know, because I've caught so many people talking smack about me because I can read lips.
There you go.
It was a thing, you know, like my sister growing up, she was, I think it was like 75 to 80% deaf. So she had to have, you know, that were quite big and quite visible hearing aids, and they didn't actually pick it up for so long because she could read lips. And my sister's super duper smart, right? So in school, that's why she was a really, really clever kid, really, really smart, intelligent student who was just so smart because she could just process everything that came out of the teacher's mouth because she could read the lips.
And so where did you learn to read lips?
Just sitting around sitting around with each other. We all did it.
Did you have, like, competitions to see who could do it the best?
Of course we did.
Yeah.
Like, it's one of those things, you know, like a family rivalry.
Joe, I want to talk to you about the work you're doing now with the workshops in dealing for people with adversity, struggles, addiction, connection and that sort of stuff. Can you tell us a little bit about that sort of work and what you do and maybe a little bit about how you do it?
You know, like, it started back in 2014 on the back of, I guess, being public about the struggles that I've been through. And what a lot of people don't understand is that even throughout my sports career and a long time as well, is that I've lived with suicidal ideation since I was a 13-year-old kid. And that little voice inside your head that tells you you're not good enough and that you'd never amount to anything, and that it planted thoughts, plans and ideas of not being here anymore every single day since that day. I guess what I come up with over many years was ways to deal with those challenges and adversities. And when it finally came to the surface, and again, back in 2014, so it wasn't a hot topic back then. It was literally the short film was launched a week out from my second WBF world title fight. So it was like, wow, this guy's just about to fight for a massive title, massive fight in Wagga. He's been going through this depression and suicidal ideation all his life, but he's still gotten through these achievements in his sporting career. So what it did was obviously raised a hell of a lot of topic, a big conversation in the community then, but also what happened out of that was a stack load of people started coming up to me saying, Joe, what you're speaking about, what it is, what you're going through, I actually go through the same thing. You've just put a voice or a label to exactly the experiences that I have. And the more people that come up to me like that, the more I thought to myself, you know, like, this is a conversation that's got to get louder. It's a conversation that needs to be had it's a conversation that was always had in the dark, you know. So it's a conversation that needs to be brought out. And it's a conversation that's real, because there's so many of these people talking about it. There's so many of these people who are experiencing exactly what I'm experiencing, and they don't feel that they can talk about it, you know. So I guess on the back of being someone who was profiled during a sports career, then going into schools and having these conversations that feelings are actually okay to talk about, it just sort of blew up from there. And where it got from there to obviously talking about my experiences with diagnosed mental illness, my experiences with suicide attempts, and my experiences with mental health ward stays. I guess in the early days, it was like I was the conduit between the people and the professional. It was like, this guy speaks about it and he goes and sees someone to speak about it. Maybe I should too, sort of thing. So it was like the conversations I was having in schools with kids was, you've got a school counsellor here. Let's go and start to talk about how we feel. To then, I guess we, you know, like, things develop over time. I was the keynote at the World Indigenous Suicide Prevention Conference in 2016 over in New Zealand, Aotearoa. And the buzz around the room there was different. This was First Nation, Indigenous, Native peoples from around the world. And if you look at it, we've all got challenges with mental health. We've all got challenges with suicide. We've all got challenges with addictions. We've all got challenges with removal of cultural and practices. We've all got challenges of residential schools and being removed away from stolen generations and things like that. And the buzz around the room was very different. The buzz around the room was, our people aren't dying from mental health. That's what it looks like. Our people are dying from the products of a change of lifestyle that's been impacted by colonization. And the ongoing development of what I then started to speak about was, if our people aren't dying by mental health, then we're dying from the impacts of trauma. So the work that I do now is more particularly based around trauma and how we behave and why we behave that way. So a lot of the work that I do now is all around why we behave the way we do, why the person's the loudest in the room, why the person is the joker, why the person is really secluded and doesn't like to talk about things, why the person gets triggered by certain music, why the person gets triggered by certain perfumes, you know. So it's about helping people to understand what their reactions are and why their brain goes into a certain state you know, throughout our lifestyle, which is this thing called trauma.
J-Man inspires and supports NDIS participants to live their best lives and promotes experiences for people with a disability. The NDIS can be confusing, so if you're thinking about applying for funding or not sure how your plan actually works, J-Man can help and guide you through every step of the process at no cost to you. jman.com.au. That's jaeman.com.au. Now is the time to get the most out of your NDIS. Call us for a free consultation. 1-800-JMAN.
Gildacare is a team of trusted, caring and professional support coordinators. Founded on the principle that it takes a village, we want to lock arms and build a long-standing relationship, one in which we are able to deliver quality support coordination. We offer additional services such as specialist support coordination and psychosocial recovery coaching. GILDA. Gildacare. Support coordination. We make the NDIS process stress-free. Google Gildacare.
I always love this segment, Doctor, here on Coach and the Doctor. It's our travel contributor, and her name is Ashley Morton. Accessible accommodation is where she's from. Have you met Ashley?
No, I've never met Ashley. I just met her a couple of minutes ago.
Now, I have a bit of a history with Ashley. We've done some stuff with the TV. We were shooting last year, and also I have interviewed her as well on the world-famous J-Pod, another podcast that comes out of J-Man and J-Man Media. Ashley, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, guys.
Accessible accommodation. Tell me what that involves, please.
Accessible accommodation, it's one of the websites under the Accessible Group. Our sister website is Accessible Experiences, but we're here to talk about accommodation and travel. And accessible accommodation is a go-to website for anybody with any, at the moment, any type of physical disability. We hope to broaden our offering to be able to include people with hearing and vision and sensory and neurodivergence, a whole lot of other additional needs. But at the moment, we're focusing on physical needs, physical disabilities. We have over 200 properties on the website that can accommodate people with physical disabilities.
With those 200 properties, are they all owned by the group or are they owned by different people? Is it a bit like an Airbnb?
Airbnb is a really great descriptor. It's Airbnb, but for people with physical disabilities. So we don't own the properties. We manage some of them. Some of the higher needs properties, we manage the properties for the owners and manage the guest experience completely for those properties. But we've got everything on there from Quest Apartments to Big Four or Ingenia Holiday Parks. We've got motel chains. We've got the small mum and pop bungalow in the backyard. We've got glamping tents. We've got houseboats. And all of them have some type of offering for people with physical disabilities. And our goal is not to make those properties as absolutely as accessible as possible, because what's accessible for one person is not accessible for somebody else. Our goal is to give the guest all of the information that they might require, what the flooring type is, how wide doorways are, what equipment is provided and photos of that equipment, photos of the bathrooms, because nobody ever puts photos of bathrooms anywhere. No one wants to see a photo of a toilet except for somebody who might not be able to access that toilet. So we give all of that information. We have 52, I think, frequently asked questions on every single property about their accessible offering, so that the information, instead of having to ask 50 questions every time you want to stay at a property, you can go to our website, find the area, find the property you want to stay at and see, yep, that property has got a commode and I need a commode, that's great. Or that property has got an electric bed. Or that property doesn't have an electric bed and I need an electric bed. But actually it says in the frequently asked questions that if I hire one, they'll accommodate that for me.
Most of the properties, I'm guessing, are for respite and or short-term accommodation. Would that be fair?
Yes, they can be used for that. But it's for anyone. You can pay privately. You can use your NDIS funds. You can just be going on a holiday. You can be going to visit your nan. We do a lot of NDIS bookings. People use our properties for STA and respite. We have a lot of people who use our properties for like interim accommodation. They might be newly injured or they're having renovations done at their house and they can't go back home until their bathroom's complete or until the ramp's installed. And so their insurance, whether that be the NDIS or some other type of insurance, hopefully, will cover the cost of them staying at one of our properties.
So what do you have for us today? Anything exciting?
In terms of properties?
Yes. What can you recommend?
Where do you want to go?
As far away as possible,
please. Fly me to the moon, please.
Well, here's some exciting news. It's not a particular property. At the moment, we are national. We're right across Australia. We've got properties from the east coast to the west coast, from the north coast to the south coast. But we very soon plan on branching out internationally, and we'll start with Asia, since they're nice and close, and New Zealand. Watch this space.
Which is great because, we'll get into it as the months go on, but the respite travel accommodation is really big in the NDIS at the moment.
Ashley Morton from the Accessible Group, thank you so much. We expect to hear from you again in probably around about a month's time.
My pleasure, guys. It was lovely speaking to you.
Thanks, Ashley.
Are you or someone you know in need of a compassionate support coordinator? Gilda Care is your team of trusted, caring and professional support coordinators. We'll make the NDIS process easy for you and your loved ones to navigate. We'll coordinate all your care and support, specialist support and, if required, psychosocial recovery coaching. GILDA, Gilda Care Support Coordination. We make the NDIS process stress-free. Visit us at gildacare.com.au.
This is Coach and the Doctor. Thanks to support coordinators Gilda Care, who specialise in, amongst many things, psychosocial recovery coaching. Coach here, not a real coach. Doctor, not a real doctor. Hello.
Hello, Coach. How are you today?
I'm fantastic today. We're recording this on a Friday.
And you've got a Friday T-shirt on.
I've got like a tie-dye T-shirt.
I know. What's going on with that?
I went to Target the other day. I go with one of my participants who I support, and we always go to Target. And we have a look, and I'm always looking for the bargains. And it was like $5 or something like that. And he loves it. He always buys a jacket every time we go. It looks it? Yeah. That went straight over my head.
Anyway, enough about us.
Enough about us. You. With us is Graham Cowan, who's an author, speaker, and board director at Are You OK, which is pretty much self-explanatory, Doctor, isn't it?
It is. Well-known and fantastic organisation.
And Are You OK Day not that long ago. Graham, thanks for joining us on Coach and the Doctor.
My pleasure, Coach and Doctor.
I suppose we start in 2000. Would you like to start in 2000?
I think so, because reading Graham's bio, we work in the disability sector, and depression and anxiety is a big part of our day-to-day lives. 2000, you went through a five-year episode of depression. What brought that on, Graham? Was there a trigger for that?
There probably was a trigger. I was working in recruitment at the time, and I was doing a lot of work in learning e-commerce space in terms of recruiting people in that area. And in 2000, the great tech crash began. And so, in a very, very short period of time, all the recruitment dried up, and it was a very, very stressful time. And it ultimately led to really serious depression, losing my job, marriage breaking down, being estranged from my kids. So it was a very difficult period.
And had you had similar episodes or less severe before that, or was this brand new to you?
No, I'd had some severe episodes before. I think this was the fifth one or fifth really severe episode that I'd had. So I knew what it was, which was great. But, for whatever reason, this one was just much, much longer and harder to get over.
Graham, can I ask you one question? You mightn't be able to answer this. At some stage of our lives, I think most people have depression, anxiety, right? What takes you from being depressed and sad and angst-ridden, if you like, or riddled, if you like, to actually wanting to take your life? What's that step?
I think it is just prolonged feeling that way. And I'd been down that way for probably 5 years altogether. You just lose hope. And there's also this really insane belief for, after you've been going through it for so long, that you're becoming a real burden to your family and that they'd be better off without you. I genuinely believe that. And I think, you know, others that do attempt suicide also, many also believe that way. And it is just so incorrect. But, you know, when you have an illness, a mental illness for a period of time, you don't think straight. You really don't.
And Graham, you had four attempts at suicide. Were they, I don't even know how to word this, were they real attempts or were they, because people often talk about a cry for help. What happened, I guess?
Yeah, they were very real. I won't mention the method, but no. it's a deadly method. And but I was just really fortunate that, you know, for whatever reason, it didn't happen for me. So I was 100% wanting to finish it.
Graham, what about the support at the time? Obviously, things have changed in the 22 years since 2000, and our awareness of mental health has increased. What about at the time? Did you have much support?
You know, I was married at the time and had a good, loving family, and so I really did. But you know, I think there was feeling of a sense of shame that I was not able to work it out myself, that I wasn't able to bounce back. So I did have that support, and but you know, again, I just felt that I wasn't really able to. I was a burden. The other thing was also just having this real physical illness as well. You know, I wasn't sleeping well. I had really low energy and anxiety combined with depression. So it just felt really, really overwhelming.
So were you talking to your family at that stage? Did they, I mean, I'm guessing they knew what you were going through, but to the level that you were going through, or friends and family?
Probably not. Not the severity of it, because it was literally, you know, every day for about 2 years, I you know, just thought about taking my own life. And I didn't say that to family. I you know, didn't want them to be distressed or whatever, but, you know, I was actually thinking about it for a long period of time.
Now, this is quite a long time ago. Is this still difficult for you to talk about?
It is sometimes. It sort of feels a bit surreal, you know, going back to then, because I now have, you know, a really good and meaningful life. And that is really one of the main messages I like to share, is that, you know, I was 100%, 110% convinced that I would never come back from this. But it was just really keeping on going, plugging away, and taking some action that really led to it coming back. And I never thought I would say this at the time, but going through that profound experience really helped me to reflect on what was important in my life. And I think my priorities changed and my sense of purpose changed through that experience. And, you know, that's why, you know, I speak at, you know, hundreds of forums in the last couple of years. I share that message because every time I share my story, it helps others to share theirs. And I really believe that as we approach Mental Health Day, we should be striving to share some stories of people in our organization, because sharing those stories really breaks down stigma, especially if the people that are sharing them are liked and respected in the organization. We've made so much progress in terms of awareness, but in the workplace, there is still a lot of stigma. There really is. And some of it not misplaced. You know, people have shared stories and found out that, you know, their career opportunities have been limited or have not been considered for good projects. So there's still some further work to do in breaking down that stigma.
So what changed for you, Graham? Because obviously you're at a pretty low point. What changed and how long did that change take?
Well, it certainly wasn't overnight, but I just really committed to beginning to walk. And I walked every day for I started off just doing 30 minutes and then probably built it up to 45 or minutes or an hour. Doing that every day and getting into nature and really trying to be present was a really good element. The other thing was then reconnecting with family and friends. You know, I'd really isolated myself and I wanted to reconnect with people. And even though I sort of didn't feel quite like I didn't, you know, I didn't know how it would go. After each meeting, I was just, it was overwhelmingly positive, you know, just in terms of talking about what was really going on. So that was an important element as well in getting back on track. And then deciding to write my book, Back from the Brink, you know, where I interviewed some prominent and everyday people who'd been through real adversity, and that gave me a sense of purpose that it was no longer just about me. I was trying to share a message, and not just my message, but other people's messages, that this doesn't last forever. We can turn it around. And then I also surveyed, as part of this book, over 4,000 people to find out what worked best in their recovery. And that was, again, just sort of really building on a sense of mission and purpose and really trying to make a difference. And when I wasn't feeling great, because, you know, this recovery is no means a straight line. You go from bad to really great in a very short period of time. It's, you know, you have your ups and downs. But I think even on my bad days, I was thinking about, you know, how if I get this finished, it will help others. That just helped me just really focus down and, you know, get something meaningful finished.
I don't know about you, Doctor, but he's very calm and relaxed. I'm feeling very calm and relaxed. Were you always this way, or did you develop this? Because you could pretty much tell me to do anything, and I'd do it for you right now.
a really important part of my recovery was meditation. It's my daily ritual. It's my one thing. If I do one thing in this day, it is to meditate for 15 to 20 minutes every morning when I get up. And then also walking in nature. So those things really, really help. And I'm a huge advocate for people trying this and evaluating this. So that's maybe why I have a calmer demeanor now.
You should meditate, Coach.
I've been told that I should meditate. And the first time I was told, and you've made this about me, Doctor, not me. The first time I was told, Graham, I have a condition, a skin condition called rosacea. Right, which is it's like I think it belongs to the dermatitis family, and you keep it under control, right? And a doctor I went to in the 80s said, you know, your biggest issue, and I was a long-haired radio DJ thinking I was cool.
case you'd forgotten, he was in radio.
Yeah, and this doctor said to me, I'll never forget this doctor's name, I won't say his name, and sent me to a specialist and said, she said, I could give you all the medicines in the world, she said, but you need to meditate. She said, that will help your skin. And I went, oh, don't be stupid. And to this day, I haven't done it.
Yeah, and look at you.
And look at me. My skin's terrible. I look 110.
Which, as we say, has got a good head for radio. But anyway, Graham, what was it like writing your first book? Because you were obviously in the corporate world. That must have been quite a process.
Daunting.
Yeah, it was. But I reached out to a few people who were authors and asked, you know, their suggestions, their advice. And I also retained quite early on an editor to help with that process, and also a group who did help with the publication part of it. But still, you know, I did have to actually write it, and of course the editor played their role. But overwhelmingly, it did remain pretty consistently my message, and you know, it was a sense of trying to build a sense of meaning for myself, and then asking people along the way for advice and suggestions. And I've always been a lifelong learner, and so was able to access some really good people who gave me some good tips.
So was it a cathartic experience?
Yeah, it was. It was, you know, really helped to get things down on paper, and somehow we're getting things down on paper. You know, I think it did play that role. And it was also, you know, really wonderful to be able to share other people's stories as well, because there was about 12 different people I interviewed. There was people like that marvellous art icon, Margaret Ollie. I interviewed her. Interviewed Liz Murray, who is Australia's best known and most famous poet. A couple of gold medal swimmers, Patria Thomas and John Conrads. And so I think having that collective number of stories, and so I would interview them, I had to have it typed out and then try and basically edit it so that it was acceptable for the book. So in many ways, the people guided the content because it was their story.
Gee, he is relaxing. Thanks again to Graham Cowan. Now, something that I have forgotten to mention in our previous Best Bits episodes, well, it's the obvious. If you want to hear the complete chats with all our guests, just scroll through our older episodes and you will see them there waiting to be listened to again. Next episode, our theme is all about Paralympians and their stories. Carol Cook and Blake Cochran join us for a riveting episode where we travel the roller coaster of being an elite sportsperson who live with disability. Okay, Doctor, it's that time.
Press hard, free copies.
Have a great week. Coach you.
You've been listening to Coach and the Doctor. Thanks to Gildacare Support Coordinators. Gildacare is a team of trusted, caring and professional support coordinators. Founded on the principle that it takes a village, we want to lock arms and build a long-standing relationship, one in which we are able to deliver quality support coordination. We offer additional services such as specialist support coordination and psychosocial recovery coaching. GILDA, Gildacare Support Coordination. We make the NDIS process stress-free. Google Gildacare.